Let's turn to Nehemiah chapter 2, please, the second chapter of Nehemiah. We're going to read the entirety, and we'll focus our attention on verses 11 through 20. Last week, we had seen that Nehemiah, his relationship with God, is described in chapter 1 as he comes to God in prayer. Nehemiah chapter 2 is about Nehemiah and his king. There's the king that's in Persia, the king that he goes and seeks permission that he might be able to go and rebuild the walls around Jerusalem. And the characteristic of his relationship with his king is that he showed respect, an ongoing respect for that king, and then also a readiness by which he had a plan so that when the king asked, what do you want me to do? He was able to give him the details. Today, we're able to see a little bit further into that planning of the man and the readiness that he has. And we see that as he's now come to Jerusalem. Let's stand together, please, with reverence for the Lord and his holy word. I'll read aloud as you follow along in your own Bibles. Nehemiah chapter 2. We're going to read the entirety of verses 1 through 20, even though we focus our attention at verse 11. Now it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine and I gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before. Therefore the king said to me, why is your face sad since you are not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart. So I became dreadfully afraid. And I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste and its gates are burned with fire? Then the king said to me, what do you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Then the king said to me, the queen also sitting beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Therefore I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river, that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertain to the temple, for the city wall, and for the house that I will occupy. And the king granted them to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. Then I went to the governors in the region beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard of it, they were deeply distressed, deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, and I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and his gates, which were burned with fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall, and I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, or the officials, or the others who did the work. Then I said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how that Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, let us rise up and build. Then they set their hands to this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king? So I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. This is the word of the Lord. Would you please be seated? In this chapter, we're seeing highlighted for us the prayer, the planning, and the providence that are found in both two places. First, Persia, but then also in Palestine. We find it, first of all, in Persia. Thank you very much, Jackie. We find it in Persia, where under the king's direction, he's able to pray and plan, and the Lord provides for him. So that the providence is especially noted when it says, the king granted my request according to the good hand of God that was upon me. The providence of God is found starting in that passage, but is seen all throughout the rest of this book. The prayer is also seen. Prayer begins in chapter 1, where we have an extended prayer of all of the different words that he says. But then prayer is alluded to when he's beginning to petition the king, and he says, I shoot a prayer up to God, and I sought the God of heaven concerning this. Prayer continues all through this book as we find the man praying while he's protecting the city from the enemies. Prayer continues as he petitions and seeks the king, and as he plans, and then as he persists in the work, he's always praying. And so prayer, the tone has already been set. The stage has been set, and he continues in that. But when it comes to planning, we had it kind of alluded to, the understanding and recognition that says, all right, he had planned in that he had known what time that it would take, and he knew all the details to ask the king. But his planning is really highlighted in this passage of Scripture. And for us to recognize that planning does not contradict providence. Providence is God sovereignly directing and guiding and overruling and accomplishing his purpose. And we know that because he is the King of Kings, he's the God of heaven, he will accomplish his purpose no matter what. But God accomplishes his purpose even through the planning of his people. So we plan because the heart of a man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. And within this passage, we're able to see providence, but we also see that in line with the planning that is being done. The planning in this passage is especially highlighted when we find his reflection in verse 11, by which he takes time, 3 days, to get refreshed, rested, and be ready to go on with his project. We see his planning also in the inspection of verses 12 through 16, where he gathers all the information that he's supposed to gain. In verse 17 and 18, we find a call to action by which he communicates with the people and calls them to the action that is given. And then finally, within the opposition that he overcomes in verses 19 and 20. We begin by seeing his planning and reflection of verse 11. So please take a look at that verse with me. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. To be there 3 days means that though he had gotten there and though he was definitely rambunctious, he was anxious to be able to jump into the work. He took those 3 days to rest, to get refreshed, to make sure that he was at the top of his game so that he's ready to take on this challenge. He gave himself to some time for rest. This follows the example of a man named Ezra. In Ezra chapter 8, just before this, we read how that Ezra had made this long journey from Persia to Jerusalem. It took 4 months journeying. I mean, I can't even imagine it. Nowadays, we could travel all the way to Jerusalem in just one day, and definitely we'd need some time to recover from that trip. But could you imagine 4 months of travel where maybe 9 or 10 miles a day you might be able to make progress? But then you set up camp, and after you set up camp, you're going to depart early so that you can get out before the sun starts beating upon you in that hot desert area. And so 4 months they'd traveled, and then Ezra takes 3 days when he came to Jerusalem to rest, to become refreshed and get himself ready for the ministry that God had called him. That's the same thing that Nehemiah is now doing. He takes those 3 days. For some of us, we are hot, burning, hard charging type of individuals who really have a hard time stopping anytime. But God has intended that we should have rest. As a matter of fact, he has designed that there'd be 1 day out of 7 that would be a day of rest. The Sabbath is intended for our rest and spiritual refreshment. And in this same line, and according to that same design and purpose and need, there's a need for this man to take those 3 days to just recharge and get himself ready. That's following along with what Jesus would say. Jesus was meeting with all of his disciples, and they had been out serving, casting out demons, healing people, preaching the gospel of the kingdom. And here's what Jesus said: come apart and rest a while. He took them on a retreat, and on that retreat, he wanted them to refresh. He wanted them to rest and get what they needed as far as rejuvenated for the ministry. This happens for many of us. If you've traveled with me to an African conference or something, you'll recognize that we get there and plan hours of rest, hopefully trying to refresh. There have been some times I've gone with Dave Wortley, and when we get to Africa, we'd have to get up and preach within 12 hours. And I'm telling you, man, that is just not a good idea. It's so much better to get there and take some time to get your wits about you, to get rested, to get acclimated. That's what this man did. That's also similar to a man named Elijah. Elijah was a prophet who had just gone through a wonderful spiritual experience. He'd been up on the top of Mount Carmel and had this contest against the prophets of Baal. And so all these false prophets were there, and he won his great spiritual victory. But after that spiritual victory came a spiritual low. He'd been threatened by a queen, Jezebel, who said that she was going to kill him as a result of what had happened on the mountain. So he ran away to hide. And when he had gone on his journey, man, all he wanted to do is die. He'd even gotten beside a brook that was there, and he said, God, just kill me. Just take me home. It's far better for me to die than to live. And in that moment of despair, there's something he needed. He didn't need psychiatric counseling. He didn't need a small group therapy. What he needed was rest. And so he lay down in the shade of a broom tree and he rested for a period of time. After he woke up, God had prepared some bread for him and water, and so he ate. So he needed food, water, he needed rest. And he goes back and rested again, and after a period of time, he was ready to go. For some of you, when you're at your moment of greatest discouragement, depression, you feel like everything's turned against you, you know what you need to do? You need to go get a little bit of rest. You just need to lay down, take a nap, get some rest and refreshment, move some of the responsibilities behind you, get a good meal, especially that some of you guys that have been in college. I'm telling you, man, in the middle of a college semester, when you feel at the wit's end and you're feeling depressed and discouraged and you think, oh, God, just kill me. Just take me home now. Well, you need to take a little bit of time and you need to rest. And once you get that rest and refreshment, this is a principle that he's laid down that is good for all of us. And there are certainly those moments where I need rest. If you wanted to ask my family, what's it like to live with Jeff Anderson, especially on a Monday? Well, you'd understand Monday is a day where I'm thinking, woe is me. The world has come to a conclusion. God, just take me home. I resign right now from the whole pastoral thing. I mean, it makes perfect sense. All day Sunday, I'm giving myself to spending energy and spiritual ministry and sacrifice and service. By the time Monday comes, well, I've made a commitment already a long time ago. I will never send in my resignation letter on Monday. It might come this Tuesday, but it will not come on Monday. I just promise how that goes. So I've decided you need rest. You need that refreshment. And here's what a man did. He takes some time for reflection. And that reflection was both physical rest and spiritual refreshment. Then he went on to inspection. Look at verse 12. I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. I went by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate, viewed the wells, the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and his gates, which were burned with fire. There's a couple of things I note about this. First of all, he gives the pattern of how he had viewed the city. Now, if I could kind of describe Jerusalem as an oblong figure, it's definitely longer than it is wide. And it's a total of about a mile and a half in the circumference around it. But if you were to think of Jerusalem in a figure such as this, then you would kind of look at the south border and you recognize that south part of the city is on the border or on the Valley of Hinnom. The Valley of Hinnom is like a refuse place. So when he called the refuse gate, that's where all the filth, all the trash of the city was thrown out into this valley, and that's where it was burned. And so when he came to the refuse gate, it was down below. He had actually started his journey on a west or southwestern portion where it was the valley gate. And so from this valley gate, he traveled about a quarter of a mile to the refuse gate. Then he continued up this side. Now when he comes up this side of the city, when he comes up the eastern border, that's called the Kidron Valley. And the Kidron Valley and the Hinnom Valley meet together, but the Kidron Valley is steep. And so when he comes to this Kidron Valley, he says that there was no place for him. There's all of this refuse, all of this ruin. The wall had been torn down, and now there's no place where his animal can even walk. I believe that he was probably riding a horse. There had been numerous horses that had come back from Persia with Zerubbabel. Could have been a mule, could have been a donkey, but more than likely it was one of these horses that had come from Persia with him. And as he's riding, there's no place for him to ride, so he now finds himself in the bottom of the Kidron Valley looking up. And as he's looking up, he's able to see where the wall had been. He sees the wall that's now throwing down the side of the valley. And he's recognizing, man, this is a formidable task to be able to get all of these ruins and clean them out and be able. Well, he continued on and he went all the way around the rest of the city. And when he had gone through the rest of the city, he enters in by the same gate. He went by night. Why would he go by night? And why would he take just a few people with him? Well, I believe that it's not because he was only inspecting the walls. And certainly he was coming to recognize what a big task it was and try to calculate how much money would it take, how much time, how many people would he need. But far more than just getting the information about the city and the walls that were there, I believe that this was a man who was gauging the lay of the land and trying to figure out what is the political scene. After all, it's been 15 years since King Artaxerxes had said, stop building the wall. And so during those 15 years, there have to be some opponents. There have to be some people who are not in favor of the wall being built. There also should be some allies. So he's coming in and he's saying, I'm not going to tell everyone what's going on. I want to gauge who is it that's on my side? Who is it that's favorable to this? Who is it that's opposed to it? So he only has a few people with him. Those few people with him are his closest, most trusted allies. And those trusted allies were people probably who'd traveled all the way from Persia with him to Jerusalem. But then when he gets there, he's saying, all right, we're not going to spread the news yet. We're going to figure out the lay of the land. Here's the inspection of the wall. Here's the recognition of the people and the obstacles that we have. And then we will announce it. He came to inspection. Now, when it comes to inspection as an application for us, anytime you're making a decision, anytime you're leading people, there's a certain amount of information that you must seek. As a matter of fact, if you're not gathering all the information to be able to make a good decision, you are going to make a bad decision. You need to make sure that you seek as much information that you gain. But listen, this is careful. This is important because leaders never have all the information. You're never going to know every detail that is there. Instead, here's a man who comes and says, I've gathered as much information as possible. I've inspected. I've rested myself. I'm refreshed. And I don't have all the information. I don't know exactly how to build all this stuff. And I don't know exactly who's going to be assigned where. I don't have all the information, but I do have enough information to now tell people what God's laying upon my heart to do. There's a fact that as a leader, sometimes you can just be so bound by the analysis of all the information. You can want to gain more information and do another study. And sometimes we call that the paralysis of analysis. And I've seen that many times. I'll sit in a board, be with a group of leaders. And there's some people who just never have enough information. They're never comfortable enough. Therefore, they have a hard time making that decision. And those are not the people who are ever going to say, let's go tackle that wall and let's get that thing done. Here's a man who's gained as much information as he possibly could. But having gained that information that he could, he now makes the decision and says it's time to go to the people and give them that information and challenge them. So we find his planning includes certainly reflection, definitely inspection, but it also includes a call to action. Within the call to action of verses 17 and 18, here's what we find. I said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how that Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of God, which had been good upon me, also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, let us arise and build. Then they set their hands to this good work. When it comes to the call to action, we're really recognizing that here's a man who's communicating some very, very important things. He's now able to communicate, number one, the situation. He has a good grasp upon the problem. And as a leader, he's the one who's identifying this is the distress that we're in. This is the trouble that we face. You see, anyone who's going to be a leader is not someone who hides their head in the sand and somehow ignores all the trouble that's out there. Instead, they are able to assess the situation and clearly identify this is the problem. This is what's taking place. Some of us would call it identifying the elephant that is in the room. Well, what may seem obvious to you, an elephant or a problem that's in the room, is not obvious to everyone. It's a leader who's willing to come and speak directly and say, this is exactly the situation that we're in. And when he assessed that situation, note what he said. He said, I want you to notice our danger. The danger was the walls are torn down, the gates are burned, we are in distress. He's coming and saying, we have no protection around us at all, and folks, we are in danger. But he went far beyond the danger, and beyond the danger, he said, but we are also a disgrace. And the disgrace says that we are a reproach. That means that here we are, we're the city of David, the city of Jerusalem. And this is supposed to be David, our king, our father, who founded this city, and now it's a heap of rubble. How could it be that we could ever be satisfied? We are a reproach. We're an embarrassment to our own heritage. But beyond that, he also says, but this is also the city of the great king. This is the city of God. This is the place where God said that he would place his temple and place his name and that God would be here. And we are now a reproach to the name of God. We are becoming a blasphemy to him. Recognize that when he recognizes the situation and calls out that situation for what it is, he doesn't just talk about the selfish danger and says, selfishly, you and your family need the safety of a wall. He comes now and goes to a higher degree. And that higher degree, he says, we are blaspheming the name of God. We are certainly a reproach to our heritage and history. We're a reproach to God, our maker. We need to do something about this. Here's someone who definitely assesses that situation. But when he calls out the trouble that is there, notice that he also identifies with that trouble. He doesn't come to them and say, look at the mess that you guys have created. Many of you have lived here your whole lifetime. What an embarrassment that you haven't even cleaned up the walls that are around here. What an embarrassment that the walls are torn down, the gates are burned, and you haven't done anything about it. He doesn't point the finger and blame them. He identifies with it and he says, we are in a reproach. Therefore, we are the ones who need to step up and build. Americans are notorious for recognizing a problem and doing everything we can to blame someone else. It's not my fault. It's the Democrats, or it's the Republicans, or it's the politicians, or it's the, you could go on and on for all the people that we want to blame. But we will never be useful to God to make any kind of difference in a society or some sort of problem that we're facing unless we take the ownership that says, I'm a part of this problem and I need to be part of the solution. Frankly, I'm calling you out now and telling us as Americans that we have got to stop being a bunch of whiners and complainers about the spiritual condition of our country. Are you listening carefully to me? I'm telling us that conservative American Christians need to stop being a bunch of whiners and complainers about the situation that is facing us, and we need to be the ones who are recognizing that we are part of the problem. This is our problem, and we need to be part of the solution. I'm not trying to talk bad about anyone, but if you as a Christian are getting all of your spiritual unction and spiritual direction from talk radio, then let me tell you, you're going to be nothing but a whiner and a complainer. A whiner and a complainer is the one who can blame everyone else, but we need to take our share and say we are the problem and we need to arise and build. Someone say amen, because I need a little help on that one. Whew, that wasn't very good. So apparently too many of you are into talk radio and you become whiners and complainers. So here's the truth. He identifies with the problem and says, this is where we are, and this is what we need to do together to assess it and to address this problem. He begins with reflection. He goes on to inspection. And based on that inspection, he calls to action by correctly identifying the situation. He names the troubles. He identifies with those troubles. And now, here's what we recognize. A true leader will never ignore the problems. So it's not as if you can just ignore it and say, oh, well, that's not a problem. We're just going to ignore that and move on. He recognizes, he acknowledges the problem, but he never focuses on the problem. Instead, he focuses on the potential. You will never be a strong leader and be useful to God for any project or useful to any particular team that you're leading if you are a problem-focused person. Yes, you can't ignore the problem. You have to address it. You need to recognize it. Call it out by name. But you must not focus upon it. You must focus on the potential that says we should arise and build. Therefore, we find him not only communicating the situation, we find him communicating the vision. He communicates the vision by saying, let us no longer be a reproach. Let us arise and build. And here's the vision. The vision is not just a safe and secure place for your future, for your family, for your grandchildren. He's not just appealing to their selfish side. He's appealing to the spiritual side that says, let us stop being a reproach. For the sake of God, for the sake of our heritage, for our spiritual reality, let us call to action. Therefore, he communicates a vision to them that says we can stop being a reproach if we'll simply arise to build. He communicates the situation, he communicates the vision, and he communicates the action. The action that he calls for is a very definite response. He said, let us arise and build. He's not addressing a problem and saying, here's some sort of vision, and then people are like, well, what do we do about it? Well, you know what he wants you to do about it. He wants you to arise and build. Now, when he calls them to arise and build, notice, he is demanding of them some very important things. Number one, he's demanding of them spiritual commitment. He's saying this is not just about your own welfare and the welfare of your family or your children. It's not about your own prosperity. I am calling you to be committed to the name of God, to the cause of God. I'm asking you to be committed to the strength of Jerusalem, not just for the local region, but the strength of Jerusalem for the spiritual purpose. And I am calling you to a spiritual commitment. These walls being torn down is not just an economic problem. This is not just a political issue or a military problem. This is a spiritual issue, and we need to rise up and stop being a reproach to the name of God. He demands of them a spiritual commitment. But he also demands of them a physical enticement, or he demands of them a physical exercise, a commitment by which they would say, look, I'm asking you to work. I'm not asking you to hire someone. I'm not asking you to appoint anyone else. I'm asking you for a physical engagement by which you give your hands to this effort and this work. You can be part. He demands of them spiritual commitment. He demands of them, second, I kept forgetting what I wanted to describe that as. It's a physical exertion. That's what I want. Physical exertion. I want you to come and put your energies into this. And finally, it demands a material sacrifice. The material sacrifice is going to say, I am going to ask of you to arise and build. Now, this takes 2 months. That means that it's 2 months that you can't be building your business. You got to be giving yourself to something else. But not only are you going to be sacrificing that 2 months of income and giving your exertion to that, I'm also asking for you to start investing in the bricks and the mortar and the stones that are necessary. I already got permission from the king to get the timbers and things like that, but there's other things that are material cost to you. And I'm going to ask you to sacrifice and give yourself to this purpose. Notice now what has happened. He's communicated, here's our situation. And here's the vision. But within that vision, here's the call to action that says, this is your part. And when he demands that part of them, because he's expecting spiritual commitment, because he's expecting physical exertion, because he's expecting material sacrifice, he better provide a good motive. He better communicate motivation. All right, so here's where we are. He's communicated the situation. He's communicated the vision. He's communicated the action. Now he communicates, this is the motivation. I'm not asking you to do this because I'm here 3 days and I'm now your new governor and we're going to, you know, make a name for ourselves. You can imagine everyone else would just tell him, hey, hang it on your own nose, man. Why don't you go back to Persia? Why don't you go back to being the king's cupbearer? Leave us alone. Stop calling us to all of this sacrifice that you have. You're out of your mind. But instead, he provides a motivation to them. And notice the motivation that he gives. The motivation is where he says, I told them that the good hand of God upon me. I told them about the king's words that he had spoken to me. So in other words, the motivation is, I'm not just motivating you saying, hey, we can do this. We can accomplish it. We can be better together. The motivation he gives is, the king has already granted us permission, but the king's words are not nearly as motivating as God's hand. God's hand is at work. And 8 months ago, I started praying about this. I looked for an open door, and the Lord opened a door where I could ask something of the king. After I asked something of the king, he said, what can I do to help you? And he said, I write some letters for me. And he gave me protection of an army that came with me. And he gave me all the... I'm telling you, the hand of God is at work. And because God is in this, we should give ourselves to this. That's the motivation. The motivation always needs to be not just the good of Nehemiah or the need of a project, but the glory of God. And the glory of God comes in and says, God is at work in this. We need to rest. We need to delight in. We need to trust in him. The one thing about this passage that it overwhelms and amazes me the most is this. Look at verse 18. So they said, let us arise and build. Then they set their hands to this good work. So they said, let us arise and build. I'm scratching my head. I'm wondering, wait a second. These are not the kind of people that I know. Human nature doesn't say, let us arise and build in this situation. Human nature says, come on, dude. You've been here 3 days, and now you're going to tell us what to do? You're going to impose some sort of tax on us to build the wall? You can take a long walk off a short pier. That's what human nature says. Human nature says, wait a second. We've been here our whole life, and now you're just coming in, big old, you know, muckety-muck from Persia, and you're coming into Jerusalem, and now you're going to tell us how to fix our problems. You go back to Persia or wherever it is that you want someone to go. I mean, you could just imagine the human nature responds in a negative way, but somehow God providentially goes before him to where the people say, let us arise and build. And they start putting their hand to the work. Here's the truth. When you're a leader, when you are trying to guide and direct other people, whether it's your family and your wife and your family, whether it is a sports team you're involved in or a business or some sort of spiritual ministry, when you are involved in leading other people, you desperately, desperately need the providence of God by which he paves the way and gives you favor in the sight of people. And I'm just speaking of that as a pastor who also happens to do some coaching and do some other things. And I look at Nehemiah, and the tendency is to look at Nehemiah and say, if you will just do this, 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 and this, then you'll have success. You're going to be able to win friends and influence people. You just follow this process and everything will go well for you. Listen, you could follow the whole process and they could write you right out of town. You could follow the whole process and they could hang you by your neck. You could follow the whole process and things don't necessarily go good for you. Listen, are there any leaders out here who would say, hey, Jeff, I mean, there's things I've tried to lead things where I do all the right things and seem to go the right direction, and I still don't get the right response of people. It's tough leading people. Come on now. Look at me. Amen. Tell me the truth. Is this right? You can do all the right things, but all those right things cannot explain a response that says, okay, let us arise and build. That is God. God has done a work in the hearts of these people, and the good hand of God is upon him, by which God gives a favor that says to all the people, let us arise and build. Let's get it done. So Nehemiah has a great source of encouragement. Wow, I've had the reflection, the inspection, had an opportunity to communicate the vision that is all there, and now people are called to action. I'm encouraged. Woohoo! It's great. Until you go to the next verse. The next verse says, now after the people said, let us arise and build. Woohoo, let's go. Nehemiah, you're the greatest leader ever. Verse 19, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us. And they said, what is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king? Within this, you can find that no matter how much reflection you do or inspection, no matter how much call to action you do, there will always be opposition. Anything that you're trying to provide by way of leadership in your home, your business, your community, your school, wherever it may be, if you're trying to provide leadership and direction and do something that is a God-sized project, there will be opposition. I'm not saying there might be. Probably, I'm telling you, there will be. In 1 Corinthians, Paul identified it by this way, saying, you know what, I'm going to go to this place. There's a wide open door, and there are many adversaries. If there's ever an open door, there are also many adversaries. And the adversaries that we have are not just physical, relational people. The adversaries that we have are spiritual strongholds, principalities and powers, the rulers of the darkness of this age. And anytime you try to do something for God, you're going to face opposition. So let me name the opposition. Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. In this case, Sanballat is named the Horonite because that's where he's from, but he's truly the governor of Samaria. That means he's an enemy to the north. Tobiah is the governor of Ammon, which means he's an enemy to the east. Geshem is the leader of the Arabs who are down in the Arabian Peninsula from the south. So he's got enemies from the north, east, south. The only reason the west isn't mentioned yet is because they're going to come later. The Aphrodites. The Aphrodites are people from the Philistines, and the Philistines are enemies from the west. They're surrounded by their enemies. And while he's completely surrounded by his enemies, we find not only their names, we find their tactics. The tactics mean that they come and they laugh at us and they despise us. Now, I believe that in verse 19, that there's an expansion. It says, they laugh at us and they say this, and they despise us and they say this. So when they laugh at us, they say, what is this thing that you are doing? Here's what happens. Opposition will consistently deride your abilities. Come on, man. You're a cupbearer from Persia. What do you know about building walls in Palestine? What do you know about any of the troubles that we have? You don't even have dirt under your fingernails. Go back to your palace, pretty boy. I mean, that's how people laugh and they mock them and they deride them and said, you are not able to do this. And then not only do they deride your abilities and say, you're just not able, but then they also defame your motivation. They then start deriding you. And when they deride you, he says a little bit further, he says, will you rebel against the king? Now, we know what you're doing. What you really want to do is you want to have a stronghold by which you're planning to rebel against the king. None of that was true, but that's always the opposition that you're going to find. Let me just tell you as an example. Some of you are taking on some spiritual goals, some spiritual objectives. You're wanting to make a difference this year. First thing that's going to happen is you're going to say to your wife and family, you know what, I'd really like to read the Bible this year. And the first thing that could happen is someone just mocks you. Pah! Read the Bible in a year? What are you talking about? You haven't read a book in 20 years. What makes you think that you're going to be able to read the Bible? What a joke. And they're going to deride your abilities. And then someone else is going to turn to you and start deriding you and saying, you're only doing this because you want the rest of us to feel bad. And you're trying to look more spiritual than everyone else. Look at Holy Joe who says he's going to read the Bible. What's the answer to that? To just stop announcing it? To stop trying to read the Bible? To stop trying to grow? No. You recognize there's going to be opposition. And now we find within that opposition, not only the names and the tactics, but now we find the response. Now this is key. The response to opposition is found right there in verse 20. So I answered them. Now, a lot of us have heard, especially from our mothers, when we're being bullied on the playground, just ignore them. You know, just ignore those little bullies because sticks and stones may break your bones, but words will never hurt you, right? Shame on you, mothers, for leading your boys down that girly track. There are times when you've got to respond to those enemies that are there. And there are times where you just ignore and continue on your own way, but there are other times where you say there must be a response. And the response was not for Nehemiah's ego's sake. The response was for the sake of the people that he's leading. He has a whole group behind him that has said, just let us arise and build. And now you have opposition. And guess what? If he doesn't address that opposition, he loses all of his following and all that momentum. And so he responds to them. He responds to them by pointing to three people. God, themselves as his servants and the enemies. And here's what he says. The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Here's what you always need to know. The first thing that you need to go to when there is opposition, people are coming against you, deriding you, questioning your motives, you need to go to God and say, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Now, here's what I love about this. The God of heaven means that he's transcendent. He's immanent. He's powerful. God can do anything. The God of heaven who has all power and all authority in heaven and earth, he is on my side. And if God is on my side, I will not fear. What can man do unto me? But he's not only transcendent, he is immanent. To be immanent means that he's near and he's caring about my success. He's caring about our prosperity. He's caring about this project. The God of all heaven will help us. And here's what you can count upon. When you are seeking to please God and working, when you're following his direction, then if God is on your side, you don't need to fear whatever man can do to you. God is on your side. Answer number one to opposition. Answer number two is opposition. As for us, we are his servants. And as his servants, we will build. Now you come back and you recognize this is not about me. It's not about my name. It's not about you making fun of me. Who cares who I am? All I am is a servant of God. And as a servant of God, we are going to arise and build. And yeah, we may fall flat on our face because the truth is, I don't have any experience in construction. And I don't have any experience in such a project. As a matter of fact, I'm just a servant of God. But God is the one who's doing it. And I am simply a servant of God. And I'm going to obey and do what God wants me to do. He points number one to God, points number two to themselves as servants, points number three to them. He comes to these enemies and he says this is powerful, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. That means that you're from Samaria. That means you're from Ammon. That means you're from Philistia. That means you're an Arab. That means that none of you have any right or power or influence here in Jerusalem. When he starts off, you have no heritage. To say that you have no heritage means that you have no legal right. You have no legal claim. You don't own any of the land here. You don't have any inheritance. You have no legal claim to this place. He says you have no right. That means that you have no moral or ethical right. You have no moral argument by which you can hinder us. You're not in the right by this. And then finally, he says you have no memorial. To say that no memorial means that you have no historic rights here. You don't have family that's here. You don't have children. You don't have parents that are buried in this place. You have no legal ground. You have no moral ground. You have no historic ground. You can say whatever you want, but we are going to continue this project because God is prospering us. We are his servants, and this is our rightful place. We will build this wall. Woo! We're only two chapters into this book, but we are well on our way to this project being accomplished. Why? Because we have a man who's respectful to his king. And as he's respectful to his king and is planning and praying, God providentially leads and says, I want you to go. But we don't only see providence in Persia. Now we see providence in Palestine. And there in Jerusalem, we start seeing a man who gives himself to prayer, gives himself to planning. But even within all that planning, God prospers him and God blesses him so that he can overcome opposition. So he can communicate the vision to the people. He did that after he spent some time in reflection and rest, seeking God. And he did that after inspection of gaining the information that was before him. I'm telling you, this chapter right here has enormous impact and consequences upon your leadership. In your family, your business, your military career, wherever it may be, wondrous things are here for that. But really, this is given for your relationship with God so that all of us can come and recognize this is not just a leadership manual. This is a manual of knowing, loving, and trusting God. Because when I pray and plan, I can trust his providence that he is for us and that he will accomplish his purpose. May we be like Nehemiah. Bow with me, please, and pray. Lord, how we thank you for this passage of Scripture. It reminds us, Lord, of our own weakness and frailty, but it also helps us recognize our responsibilities in leadership, responsibility to rest and become refreshed and take care of ourselves so that we can be strong and have you renew our strength. Responsibility, Lord, to gain information, to inspect the situation and come to a proper assessment. And when we see the problem, whatever it is, but to take ownership of it, to not point fingers at others and try to blame them and try to protect our own interests, but help us, Lord, to identify so that we can cast a vision that says, let us stop being a reproach. Let us do something for the Lord. Let us honor him. Oh, Lord, I pray that we would face opposition this year. I pray for that opposition, because if we're not facing opposition, we're not accomplishing anything worthwhile. Help us, Lord, to recognize who those opponents may be. Help us, Lord, to respond to them appropriately. Help us to continue in the work. And Lord, let us accomplish great things for you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.